And our first presenter this morning is Bill Ammons. Bill has been in the broadcast industry for more than 30 years in both the engineering and marketing sides of the aisle. Bill has designed and developed a wide range of products from FM transmitters and exciters to wireless microphones and audio processing. Bill has finally moved up the tower and is now involved with the marketing and product development of TV broadcast antennas at Micronetics Communications. Bill is one of the principals of Micronetics, which is located in Lewiston, Maine. And I think that Bill's discussion today will prove what most of us already know, that antennas are fun. Among the things that Bill will discuss this morning will be an application called Super Duper Television. Bill Ammons.
Well, thanks, and I'm glad to be back up here. This was a very interesting trip. I've seen cows flying backwards. I've seen buildings tilted over. Chicago went by about, 3 o'clock yesterday, and hopefully the weather's going to settle down a bit. What I'm going to talk about this morning is antenna design and how, as a manufacturer, we are looking at ATSC MH, and as customers come to us, what practical design considerations there are, and kind of give you guys an under-the-radar look at antennas. Most of you, when you buy a television broadcast antenna, big truck shows up, it's nice and shiny and orange, and then it goes up in the tower and you don't get to see it again. So this is kind of an inside look about the antenna, some design rules, some ways of thinking about mobile TV versus conventional fixed over-the-air broadcasting. You know, with mobile TV, you're not getting this, you're not targeting the exact same audience. Your audience is moving around. A lot of times it's closer, and if you're going to have particular geographical constraints, you want to address those so you have solid mobile coverage as well as good over-the-air coverage. So let's take a look here. Okay, we're going to look at azimuth patterns. There are some differences in azimuth patterns with mobile and using elliptical or circular polarization we ought to take a look at, how elevation patterns are formed, and adding a vertical component, elliptical versus circular, and then we're going to look at a couple design cases here for a television broadcast facility to give you a kind of some ideas of things to take a look at. Okay, azimuth pattern differences. Something that a lot of engineers and consultants don't know too much about is there are differences between a horizontal azimuth pattern and a vertical azimuth pattern in quite a few designs. To give you a quick, again, this is just quick antenna engineering. If I take a piece of aluminum pipe and I cut one set,
Okay, if I take a piece of aluminum pylon and I cut a single set of slots in it for an omnioid pattern, we've got a pipe and a slot, and that's about it. If I want to go to a cardioid pattern, I can add some winglets on here to start to directionalize the pattern. If I want omnidirectional, I'm going to go to a bigger pylon, and I'm going to use three or four slots cut around it to get a good omnidirectional pattern. Here's a case of the omnioid antenna. This is the simplest pattern you can do with the UHF slot antenna. And if you look at the differences between the vertical and horizontal patterns, you notice that the horizontal pattern has a maximum of 100% over about a 70 or 80 degree beam width. And the back of the pattern goes down to about 65%. Those are the currents that are forming along the pylon. In the vertical pattern, you notice that the vertical pattern has a lot more constriction against the back, and we'll take a look at why that happens. But again, if you're planning on using an omnioid pattern for mobile TV, you'll find if you're looking basically to shoot at one direction for mobile, the backside of the pattern is going to constrain you quite a bit. Cardioid patterns. Cardioid patterns are a lot closer due to the fact that the large peristytics that are on the antenna tend to form the vertical and horizontal patterns fairly closely. In most cases, the horizontal pattern will have a slightly lower azimuth gain than the vertical pattern. They're typically fairly close. In this case, I think the difference is, you know, we're looking about a quarter dB difference, and off the back of the array, we're looking at about 10% difference in field.
It's not a lot. And if you're up on a mountain ridge and you're shooting into a city, this type of pattern would actually work quite well. Here's another, a little bit more narrower cardioid. Same thing, the vertical pattern is a bit tighter off the backside. You get a little bit less signal. But over the main beam of the signal, you do about fairly close to the horizontal pattern. So it works out pretty good. Here's a peanut pattern. Now, peanut patterns, there's numerous different ways of forming peanut patterns. We can do it with two slots and multiple peristytics. We can do it with a single slot and a couple peristytics. But same design rule here, that the vertical pattern off the backside typically is a little bit tighter than the horizontal pattern. But in this case, this particular pattern, if you were trying to replicate over a particular pair of cities or something, would really work pretty well. Okay, omnidirectionals. Omnidirectionals, if you're going to cover a broad area, let's say that your transmitter is fairly close in the middle of the city, or you've got to have pretty much equal coverage, omnidirectional is the way to go. Typically, the vertical pattern will be scalloped a little bit more than the horizontal, but in most cases, you'll be within about 5 to 10%, again, depending on the frequency, the size of the pylon that's used for the antenna, and the number of slots that you have around here. In this case, we have three slots that are spaced at 120 degrees apart around the pylon. For a given pylon size, if we took and said, okay, we're going to take this 12-inch steel pylon out to the shop, and we're going to put slots in it for an omnidirectional antenna. If we built the first antenna at channel, let's say, 17, we might have a pattern very close to this one. But if we took that same, another 12-inch diameter pylon and said, okay, we're going to build a channel 48 antenna, you will have more scalloping in the pattern. So as you go up in frequency for a given type of antenna, typically you will have a little more scalloping. Okay, elevation patterns. I'm going to give you kind of a little look at how they're formed and kind of take some of the mystery out of how the antenna array is put together. In this case, we have a 10-bay UHF slot antenna, and the elevation pattern that's up on the top is 10 bays. There's no beam tilt, no null fill. In this case, each of the radiating slots is equally spaced with each other, and you get a perfectly symmetrical pattern. There is no beam tilt, no null fill. The elevation gain at this point is 12.36, and something that we talk about in the factory is the electrical length of the antenna. You know, you can go down the hall, hey, what's the array length of the antenna you're working on? Oh, it's 3,600 degrees. Oh, really? So in this case, this antenna is 3,420 degrees electrically long, or 19 times 180. So we want to get a little bit of beam tilt and null fill in there. What do we do to this antenna? Example number two is I've introduced some shortening of the first two elements of the antenna. I've actually physically taken the slots and I've moved them closer together. So the array is effectively getting bent a little bit. In this case, we've reduced the spacing by 20 degrees for a total of 40 degrees of length. So our antenna actually has dropped in length 40 degrees, and it's now only 3,380 degrees long. You thought you were paying for a 3,420-degree antenna. You're not getting it. You're only getting 3,380. We're making a little bit of money by saving attached money on the aluminum. But in this case, the elevation gain has dropped. You notice there's a little bit of first null fill, it's just a couple degrees or a couple percent. The elevation gain has dropped and the beam is actually tilting over just a little bit. Okay, we've taken that same array and we're shaving a little bit more off of your antenna. In this case, we're taking the two elements again and making them even a little closer together. At this point, we're reducing the spacing by 48 degrees. And again, if you notice, the beam tilts come up a little bit. The first null fills come up a little bit. The gain is dropping because as we increase the null fill, we're transmitting more signal off the main beam, so the main beam is actually dropping in peak elevation gain, and we've reduced the length to 3,324 degrees. Okay, we'll take it a step farther, and we've now increased the beam tilt to 7/10 of a degree, but we're now having, we've dropped the spacing of those two additional, those two slots by even more, another 56 degrees from the example of number three. The antenna is 3,268 degrees long. You notice the gain has dropped to 11.18, and the first null fill has gone up to 10% first null. And in this case, there's a nice slope to the pattern here. So if you're for a cell phone-like application, this would be a perfect, perfect pattern. We can do some other things with beam tilt and null fill, but typically in an antenna design, if it's an end-fed antenna, your beam tilt and null fill is achieved by your short spacing of the elements. We can do more. We can take the next two elements and we can short space those to get some additional beam tilt. We can also apply some averaging to help push up the null fill a little bit. But that's basically the differences in the pattern, how we set it up. So as we increase the beam tilt, we're actually selling you a little bit less antenna. Okay, adding a vertical component. For mobile handheld devices, the antenna is not going to be in a fixed location. People are walking around. The mobile device is going to be held at different angles. The old school way of thinking of just horizontal is changing. About 85% of the antennas that come through our shop now are elliptical or circularly polarized, and this is for VHF and UHF. One of the reasons that it's important to add an elliptical or circular component is something called Faraday rotation. That's something I learned about back in the 70s when I worked for a television station, public TV station, putting up receiving antennas. That when you have Faraday rotation of a horizontally polarized signal, you might go up to a particular point, put up your antenna, and you have almost no signal because the signal has become polarized in the vertical plane or in an elliptical, somewhere in the elliptical plane. Well, with handheld devices, obviously, as we're walking down the street, we're going through knolls, we're going through reflections, and we want to have a signal available so the mobile device, at any angle it's being held and in any environment it's being walked through, always has signal available to it. Okay, a quick review of the slot antenna. This is the technology has been around for quite a few years, but it's a TEM mode coaxial structure. The slots are spaced typically at a lambda. Actually, it's 358 degrees for the actual spacing that we use in the factory, not 360, because a little bit of propagation delay along the pylon. So again, instead of selling you a 360-degree antenna, we're only giving you 358. Just wanted to let you know. The slots are typically around 8/10 of a lambda long. And if we take you out to the machine shop and hand you the plans to build the antenna, typically that's about what you're going to see. There are some variations in these designs, and they work fairly well. Now you might ask, you've got a vertical slot, but you've got horizontal polarization. Well, the slots are excited, but they actually form a horizontal electrical field. So how do we get a vertical component out of this? The elliptical or circular polarized antennas. Okay, well, we still use the same slot design, but what we do, since we have a standard slot that gives you an electrical horizontal field, we need to induce a vertical component to that. So to do that, what we do is we add some external polarizing elements. These elements are an eighth lambda each long. They are over the slots, and they will then extract field just like the slot will, but it'll launch it actually in a vertical mode. It's in quadrature, it's 90 degrees out of phase, and we can control the amount of vertical field coming out of the antenna by varying the position of these polarizers, how far they are from the slots. We can vary the length slightly. So as we couple into the structure, we're actually bringing the elements in to try coupling up to the same amount of field as we've got in the horizontal plane for CP. It's very simple. Now, these white things here, they have nothing to do with polarization. That's another, we have a term for those that we use in the shop. It's called a radome stop. Probably never heard of that. But that actually keeps the radome. We have several of these around the antenna array, and the white Teflon structures keep the radome give it some support, and also so it, with windy conditions, will stay in a nice circular fashion. For antenna design, we can go from 10% of a vertical component all the way up to a full circular. And the question gets asked quite a bit, how much of vertical component should I have? Typically, about a 70-30 ratio seems to be the sweet spot for handheld devices. The feeling of a couple of us in the company is as you get more into an urban environment, if you've got the transmitter power to do it, go for circular. You're pushing that much more signal into an urban environment where you have a lot more chances of reflections, Faraday rotations, and trying to just basically getting that extra dB or two advantage to keep away from the cliff effect. Now, the picture here is a channel 13 omnidirectional slot antenna, as you can see, and that pylon's about 18 inches in diameter. Now, here's a bit of trivia. Did you know your bat wing antenna, you may already have a little bit of circular polarization or vertical component? Batwing antennas typically, depending on the frequency of the antenna versus its design, can produce up to about 10% of vertical field. The slot antennas, just like the batwing antennas, you have actually, you have a basically a slot form from the pylon to the inside of the batwing element that actually, again, produces a horizontal electrical field. But those vertical elements, also because of the way the bat wing element's laid out, can actually produce some vertical. It depends on the frequency variation of where you're at. For example, this is a high-band antenna. A bat wing high-band antenna is cut to resonate at the low end of the band, right below channel 7. The elements are resonating at about 165, 168 megahertz. The inner bay spacing is at 1 lambda at channel 7. If you were broadcasting on channel 7, you'd probably have about 8% of vertical component. If you then switched channels and started going up in frequency, again, now that you would have more than a lambda spacing between the bat wing elements, that vertical component's going to start dithering away. But down at channel 7, you have the best chance of actually having some vertical component that you're already transmitting. So if you've got a channel set, if you're on channel 7, you've got a channel 7 bat wing, you probably got a little bit of vertical there already. Okay, here's some of the questions we get, and we're working with consultants and station engineers on projects. Some things we take a look at. What ERP is needed, the transmitter size that you're trying to target to go with, your transmission loss, how high you, how long a transmission line you are, and then a new question that your traditional over-the-air broadcaster is looking at the old model of trying to take the beam and push it out towards the horizon, filling in some close in, but with mobile handhelds, you may have a second goal of trying to cover another audience. It might be something close in, for example, instead of looking at the tower here in High Point Road and saying, well, we want to get out 60 or 70 miles, we might want to optimize the signal so that the core of downtown is very heavily saturated with signal for mobile handheld devices. Are you in an urban or rural area? Urban areas, again, we tend to say push towards circular polarization, heavier null fill. We want to get more signal in to try getting into buildings, try to get around buildings so that the mobile viewer has a consistent signal to watch. And then transmitters. Now, back in the good old days, we had one transmitter. Now we're looking at single frequency networks, repeaters. And we might say we want to do mobile, but we want to do it with several different transmitters sites to try to improve reception over just the single transmitter model. Okay, let's look at some sample projects. This is, again, some of the stuff we look at every day. And I've come up with four projects. Some of them are projects we've worked on and changed the names to protect the innocent. And the one at the bottom, Super Duper World, that's coming to Orlando very soon. You can go down and visit. But project number one, we've got a 48-kilowatt DTV station. We've got a city of about 350,000 people. And it's a very urbanized core. Everybody's within about 10 miles of downtown. After that, you have some outlying farms, and that's about it. In this case, the antenna's up on an office building. It's only 400 feet up. So line of sight's about 24 miles. And since 95% of the population's within 10 miles, you have visual line of sight without everybody from the office building. One of the things that this particular site we want to look at is we've got two fairly large universities close in to the transmitter. And the demographics of the students suggest that they would probably be larger handheld users. Now, what if somebody wants to come in and lease some space on your channel for some ATSC-MH applications for university-oriented programming, or maybe the university itself wants to have its own channel and comes to a local broadcaster and say, I want to put ATSC-MH on your transmission and use it to basically communicate with our student populations. Project number two, 15-kilowatt low-power digital station. This one, you have a city of 2 million people, and it's up on a fairly sharp ridge. The problem here is that for 15 kilowatts, you've got a couple problems. You want to obviously get the signal out so that you have the cable head ends and people that have over-the-air reception ability that they can get out 25 or 30 miles. They also, in this case, wanted to have a fairly good signal over the downtown core for mobile handheld devices. And they've got another constraint that population starts at about 16 degrees below the antenna. You're looking right down at the houses, so we don't want to overshoot the housing that's right down there with either mobile or for over the air. Project three is a 400 kilowatt station. It's high up on a mountain. Here we've got a core that's about 7 miles away. It's a big entertainment district. In this case, we've got to hit cable heads and translators that are 100 miles out. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we've got a very strong signal right in the core of the city so the handheld devices work the best. And we also want to optimize the antenna elevation pattern for the transmitter we have available to it and also look at RF exposure issues. Project number four, Super Duper World. This is completely fictional, but let's just say that you're a large resort sitting in Orlando. You have I-75, and you have all these vans and cars full of kids coming down, thousands and thousands of kids coming down to visit this theme park. So for the last 200 miles or so between the Georgia line and Orlando, are we there yet? Well, with mobile devices in the vehicles, they start putting up some billboards right about the Georgia line saying, you can watch Super Duper World TV tuned to channel 17 now. And you've got five or six channels of sugar-coated advertising and the character, theme characters and the rides and all the good stuff for the kids. And they're sitting there mesmerized for 2 hours, 3 hours, as they just get completely sugar-coated. For an advertiser standpoint, if you've got a low-power station, the Super Duper World goes to the local community, let's say it's in Ocala, and says, well, the city of Ocala, I'm going to give you the standard definition channel, so you've got a public channel. We can have our license, but we're going to have all the sugar-coated stuff. And then they can go to the advertisers in a particular market and say, well, this particular cell is within 5 miles of your McDonald's on I-75 and Route 28. The local restaurants and hotels would be more inclined to advertise for another source of revenue. The receivers then look at the particular PCIP codes and know to hop to the next cell site when they get down the road. So you get a continuous long transmission of these sugar-coated commercials. The receivers are coming out that will do that and do it very well. So you can have basically entertainment district advertising for high hydro areas. It could be something like up here in Baraboo. You could put a site here, one up in Baraboo, and have mobile video that talks, you know, basically as a sort of almost Barker channel using a fairly low power station. So let's take a look at a couple of these things here. Project number one. You got a 5 kilowatt transmitter, you're on top of the building, 95% of the viewers are close in. Outside, you've got 5% of them that are out in the farms outlying. Antenna pattern. Well, we're sitting in the middle of the city. We want a mobile handheld component or a vertical component. We saw what the Omnioid pattern looked like. It did not have a very good circular pattern to it, so we're going to go with just a standard omnidirectional pattern. Okay, vertical component. We don't have a super heavy urban core. The building structures aren't that heavy, so we looked at it and said, well, 70-30 would be a good place to look at. So basically, the quick computation is it's 3/7 of the power times 48 kilowatts in your horizontal plane or about 20.5 kilowatts in your vertical plane. You add your two ERPs together and you get about 68 kilowatts. You have a 5-kilowatt transmitter. There's only about 100 foot of 3-inch heliacs going up to the antenna because the transmitter is up on the elevator penthouse. So you run backwards and say, well, you need at least 13.71 of antenna gain to do this. So a 14-bay antenna, you're probably in a pretty good spot to make this thing work. Okay, now what do we do for an elevation pattern? Well, I've got a couple things to consider. Number one, we obviously have people outside of town that we want to hit. There's outlying cable heads that are 30, 40 miles out that are going to get this signal. So we don't want to over-tilt the signal so that we're pushing everything into the city. But we want our mean touchdown to still be right close to the horizon. In this case, it's just about 22 miles versus the electrical line of sight's about 24.5 miles from this. So a half degree of beam tilt. And something we want to do, because we want a good, heavy concentration of signal close to the transmitter site, because we have the universities close by, and we want to ensure that we get good reception. What we do is we actually go in and we do some outphasing of the array so that we don't have the nulls here touch to zero until we get down to probably about 25 degrees. This is minus 20 degrees here. At this point, at about 19 degrees down, you're about 1,200 feet away from the tower. At this point, which is about 8 degrees down, you're about 4,000 feet away. And then 2 miles away, you're sitting at about 65% of field. So the bulk of your viewers are right in this neck of the woods here in the urban core. So you've got a fairly thick signal. So this should work pretty good. You should not have any significant nulls or dead spots, and it should work very nicely for handheld devices within the urban core and also provide excellent coverage for the people that are outside the market. And here's the polar plot. This is a distribution of power. It's a little bit different from the standard Cartesian pattern. But here you're looking at the horizon. You notice the beam's tilted just a little bit below the horizon. This is going vertically above the antenna. This is pointing straight down. And most of your viewers, again, are going to be right in this neck of the woods from about a half degree down to about 12 to 15 degrees below the horizon. So it's a pretty compact little pattern. This is a low RFR antenna we built for the project, which allowed the antenna to be mounted on the top of the office building on a short tower section and not overly radiate the top of the building. Okay, a 15-kilowatt low-power digital. We've put in quite a few antennas for low-power digitals, and if they're done right, 15 kilowatts can do some pretty good distance. In this case, we have a pretty good-sized city. We have population out to 30 miles, and most of the population's within 10 miles. And again, it's 1,800 feet above the valley floor. We go up to the transmitter site, and we're actually looking down to see the first housing that's about 16 degrees down. So we don't overshoot those. In this case, there's not a lot of population behind the ridge where we're transmitting from, so a good broad cardioid works. And if we look at the differences between the horizontal and vertical planes, they're pretty good out front, so this pattern would work pretty well. This station was a Class A station, 150 kilowatts, so they converted their transmitter to digital. They had quite a bit of transmitter left, so I said, okay, how much transmitter do you want to use? Well, we've got 2.5 kilowatts to work with. Okay, if we've got more transmitter power, let's use a little more transmitter power and pull back a little bit on the antenna gain. When we're looking at antennas and what we're trying to accomplish, sometimes a small difference in bay count of an antenna can make a lot of difference. And so we go, you know, to the consultant and to the station, say, what's your goal here to try, you know, what you're trying to accomplish? Well, we've got a couple of things we want to do here. We've got the urban core is about 4 degrees below the horizon. That's fairly close in. It's got some fairly dense buildings. So we want to make sure we have enough signal in the urban core so handheld users have a good consistent signal. We've got cable heads out 30, 40, 50 miles away. The valley floor actually slopes up, so in the far end of the valley, you actually have viewers that are at the same elevation as the transmitting antenna. There are some markets that do that. In fact, if you look at Anchorage, Alaska, Anchorage has quite a bit of population that's actually above the downtown elevation of the transmitting antennas. So you're actually looking above for population. So that's the guys that are transmitting from downtown and Anchorage tend not to use too much gain because they want to get the viewers that are actually above their elevation. In this case, we said, okay, we've got enough transmitter power. Let's run the elevation pattern of a 12-bay antenna, and we're going to try to optimize the antenna with enough null fill and beam tilt to get a pretty good signal. So we ran and built a 12-bay array. We added enough beam tilt and null fill so that the pattern looked pretty good. The 12-bay is in blue, and our first null fill is about 14%, and we have more than 10% of field all the way out to about 15 degrees. Well, if we look at the ERP calculations, close in, right at the edge of the population, close to the transmitter, this is looking at about 16 degrees down, the 12-bay antenna gave us 37.5 watts of ERP in the horizontal plane. It's not a lot. Close in, it'll work, but again, we don't want to overshoot everything. The first null's not bad. It's about 13 or 14%. But we went to the urban core and say, okay, well, here's the signal at the urban core. We actually have an effective horizontal ERP of 2.24 kilowatts out of the 15-kilowatt low-power digital. Well, we went back and said, okay, you've got enough transmitter power. Let's run a 10-bay antenna. Again, it's going to be a little bit broader beam. And as we drop the amount of bay count, we have a little bit more control over null fill and beam tilt than we do with 12-bay. So I said, okay, let's do the 10-bay. And we want to try, in any case, because we've got viewers up and we've got cable heads that are going to be close to the horizon, we want to try getting about 95% of field at the horizon. And the 10-bay obviously is going to give us a little bit of advantage because it's wider in beam width. But we tilted a little bit farther down. So at the urban core, now we've got 5.24 kilowatts versus the 2.24. We've got a 4 dB advantage. And again, when you have the cliff effect, 4 dB is a nice number to have. In this case, the null fill is out a couple more degrees. It's a little bit higher. We continue out with about 15, 16% of field minimum out to about 18 degrees down, and that's at the edge of the valley floor. big difference here with the close-in housing that we've gone from 37.5 watts to 759, or a 13 dB advantage. So again, that cliff effect, if we can bank you 13 dB, that is a large number. So just a small difference in the antenna size, beam tilt, and no-fill can make a big difference. So a lot of times the conventional way of saying is, well, I'm going to use a 5-kilowatt transmitter, give me an antenna that will fit. With mobile handheld, you might want to turn around and say, okay, how much signal do we need to get at a particular location, work up with an antenna, and balance it up with the transmitter. So it might be buying a transmitter with an extra couple of power modules, or maybe the next size up if you're really trying to cover handheld in a fairly tough environment. Okay, project three, 400 kilowatt station. They're up, way up on a mountain. The city's not that far away. The 95% of the population they cover in the urban areas within about 17 miles. They do have a situation where they feed a lot of cable head ends and translators. So, well, look at that. Close-in population, again, this is out west. We're looking at a high transmitter site. For the first couple miles, we're looking at rock, a couple javelinas, and maybe a couple other critters running around as possible viewers until we get to the edge of the city, which becomes densely populated. Examples of this, Las Vegas, Albuquerque, Tucson, Salt Lake City. The transmitters are all high up and away from the population, and for the first 3 or 4 miles, there are no viewers. The depression angle that the first viewers hit at, it varies anywhere from 20 degrees below the horizon to about 6 degrees below the horizon. Okay, the other problem the station has, they've got a transmitter that the station engineers found. It's a dual cabinet transmitter. They were running on analog, and they found that in digital, it really reduces the amount of maintenance time and off-air when the transmitter is actually run down in about the 20 kilowatt region. So it doesn't. The transmitter was supposed to be able to do about 40, but in reality, the transmitter is a lot happier at 20. The cooling costs are less. They don't blow modules. They just don't have any problems. So they said, you know, instead of a six-hour trip up the mountain to work on the transmitter, we'd like to run about 20, 25 kilowatts. High tower rental cost because it's the only tower that's up there, so the tower owner, of course, charges by the foot or by the inch. And then, and since it's right off of public land, we've got an RFR problem that they can't overly fence the site, and they want to contain RFR so that the public nearby has access to the public land. Okay, this project, we kind of synthesized things up, went back and forth, and said, we got to do a couple things here. They wanted to cover the urban core very nicely. They wanted it to be, this antenna to have enough signal at the horizon or close to the horizon so the cable companies and translators all get a feed. And they wanted enough signal so that the downtown and entertainment district area had a very strong signal for mobile handheld users. The university has the stadium down there. The feeling was the university's there. They wanted to have a really good handheld mobile environment. So in this case, at the horizon, we don't really need 100% of field. A 400 kilowatt station that has about 80% of field at the horizon at 7,700 feet going into a cable head or translator, it's going to go out 100, 150 miles into a good cable head end system. So it's not a problem with having a lot of gain. In fact, if we were running 15 kilowatts on this site with a fairly good signal at the horizon, the cable heads would still get a very good signal. In this case, we're going to over tilt this a little bit. We're going to go down, and we want to look at the core of the city. This is downtown, and we want to ensure that we had enough. Okay, here's our 400 kilowatt guy again. We wanted to have a fairly good signal in the urban core, so we pushed the antenna beam down, and by using an 18-bay antenna, we were able to take the second main lobe and place it right over downtown and produce a fairly healthy signal. It's about 40, in this case you're getting about 44 kilowatts downtown, so it's a fairly meaty signal. and we wanted to have enough extended knoll fill so that 5 miles away we had enough signal at the edge of the valley where the population starts. So this actually worked out pretty well, and it should work out very well for mobile handheld because in the urban core we have a pretty good signal. The original plan for this station by the original owners was to use a 32-bay antenna. I looked at the elevation pattern of the old 32-bay antenna. They were going to run about 700 kilowatts. They would have had about 7 or 8 dB less signal downtown with a higher power station than going with lower power and a lower gain antenna. So this should work out pretty well with handheld. Okay, project number 4. This is the mythical super-duper world that you can come down and visit. I'm selling tickets now if you want to buy one. And what they want to do is they want to provide mobile handheld reception up and down Interstate 75. And in doing that, they want to put up a network of stations using low-power digital stations, typically 300-400-foot towers. And essentially about a peanut pattern. In this case, since the peanut pattern pretty much goes up and down the highway vertically and horizontally, should work out pretty well. The cell sites or LD stations are placed about every 15 to 20 miles. And it should provide actually pretty good coverage. So this particular application, going up and down a highway, it works pretty well. Okay, elevation pattern. You're on a low site. You're only a couple hundred feet above ground level. You're in a rural area. You're not going to get out that far. You're looking at about a 17, 18 mile at the most line of sight. So we want an antenna that has a minimal amount of beam tilt to it, but we don't want the signal to go to zero close in. So what we do is we just tap the beam tilt a little bit. We took the example from our earlier slide, the 10 bay, and we don't have any nulls or zeros until we get down to about 40 degrees, and that's only about 290 feet away from the tower. So there's a nice decline in the signal as you go down. The first null is about a half mile away from the cell site or LD site, so it should actually work out pretty well, provide good solid coverage with these stations spaced about every 15 to 20 miles. It should provide some very seamless coverage. Okay, this is something to kind of look at every day. Plan your directional patterns carefully, because in the vertical and horizontal, you do have differences. The cost-benefit ratio, typically about a 70-30 ratio, is the sweet spot. Going above that will gain you something, but it's like putting a fifth engine on a 747. It'll take off faster, but it's not going to go any faster, and it's going to burn up a lot more fuel. So we found about 70-30, or about a 42% vertical component, works pretty well. Obviously, the elliptical or circular polarization will add a little bit of weight to an antenna. It's not from the polarizers. The polarizers in the Channel 13 antenna you saw, they only added about 35 pounds to the antenna, but we ended up putting a bigger radome on because we wanted some distance between the radome and the polarizers to minimize any effect from icing. So the antenna's radome got a little bit bigger. Same thing with the side-mounted antenna. It does grow a little bit. When you're looking at mobile handheld, look to lower gain antennas. You can get a broader beam width. You have more control over null fill and beam tilt. On a 32-bay antenna, you start to really lose the ability to do a lot of things with the antenna. So lower gain. There's a lot more magic we can work to make the antennas do very well. And if you have any questions, I'll be here through the morning break. Pictures that are up there, the big orange shiny thing is a Channel 8 elliptically polarized antenna. The white antenna down at the bottom is a elliptically polarized side-mounted slot antenna. And the waterfalls up there are in Lewiston, Maine, where our plant is. Thanks very much. Any questions?
Your drawings show the obvious difference in the horizontal plane pattern between polarizations, but the assumption is that there's no difference in the vertical plane. Does that turn out to be the case?
Right. The elevation pattern is going to be the same. but the horizontal azimuth pattern is the one that's changed. And the reason for that is very simple. If you took the omnioid antenna and you place those vertical elements out in front of the antenna, the pylon is actually acting as a reflector, so you don't get the same current flow around the antenna. So in the azimuthal plane, there's differences in the vertical versus the horizontal elevation patterns. Now, there's doesn't change that. Great, thank you. Oh, great, thank you.